Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, welcome to the third in the Sydney Institute series of virtual talks and discussions. And today, Ursula Dubosarski makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She'll be well known to some of you, if not many of you. She's a children's writer, and since February, she's been the Australian Children's Laureate. She's won numerous national and international awards for her writing on her writing about children and her writing of children's books. And today she's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic of children, reading and libraries. And after the talk, Anne Henderson's going to talk to Ursula about her talk and about her career and her writing. Ursula, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank you for the invitation. I'm here speaking in my capacity as the new Australian Children's Laureate, as Gerard said, for 2021. And I'm going to be speaking to you about children, reading and libraries, now in this time of the plague. Just a little bit of background first about the position, because I'm often asked what actually is the Australian Children's Laureate. And a laureate, of course, is a traditional honour in the Western world, originating in the great sporting contests of ancient Greece, with a laurel wreath as top prize. And over the centuries, has taken on a general sense of high honour, Nobel laureates, for example. When it comes to literature, though, the word's most frequently associated with the Poet Laureate, I think, a British institution dating back to the 17th century, which awards a small pension to an eminent poet who in return is expected to compose some lines of poetry on significant public occasions. And it was the then Poet Laureate, Ted Hughes, who in the 1990s raised the notion of a separate Laureate of Children's Literature. Hughes, of course, also wrote with great distinction for children. As a result of a conversation between Hughes and the acclaimed British children's writer Michael Mopergo, the first children's laureate was appointed in the UK in 1999, and it's a two-year term, and the purpose is to honour a British writer or illustrator for children, and comes with a small pension in return for service to the community, not so much writing public poetry, but celebrating, supporting and nurturing reading and literature for children. This idea was taken up fairly quickly around the world, and there are now children's laureates in the United States, the Netherlands, Ireland, Wales, Sweden, and from 2008, Australia. The Australian Children's Laureate follows much the same form as the British Children's Laureate, one significant difference being that while in Britain, the laureate is awarded a silver medal upon appointment, here in Australia, the laureate is presented with a life-size statue of a magpie. For clarification, in Australia, the Children's Laureate is not a government appointment, nor is it associated with any library or school or any other institution. It's a small, private, charitable organisation called the Australian Children's Laureate Foundation that chooses the laureate and funds the position. So, with my trusty magpie in hand, all through 2020-2021, as the new Australian Children's Laureate, I'll be doing whatever I can to encourage, support and celebrate a love of reading in Australian children. Before the coronavirus hit us, this was intended to involve a great deal of travel all around the country and overseas, talking with as many children, parents, educators, librarians and organisations devoted to the needs of children that I could. Now we've all had to rethink, and time will tell what the Australian Children's Laureate will get up to in these new, rather sad circumstances. There's no instruction booklet for the laureate. I've been free to choose whatever way I wish to approach it. And like all freedoms, that's a little daunting. I'd known I was going to be the laureate some months before the news was made public in February this year at a ceremony at the National Library in Canberra. So I had time to think about what I could do that I felt would be meaningful and perhaps not just a laudable reiteration of what a great thing reading is. After all, I've yet to meet anyone who's actually against reading. If there was a national referendum tomorrow asking, do you think Australian children should be good readers, we can be pretty sure that everybody would tick the yes box. We all want our children to be good readers, and by a good reader I mean someone who reads a lot and is comfortable reading a broad range of literary material across time and culture. In other words, a fully literate citizen of the world. That's surely what we want for all our children. Nobody wants a future society where only a sliver of the population are good readers, while the rest of us make do reading text messages and Facebook posts. And yet, I think all people involved in the area of children's reading have to wonder, is reading as a more sophisticated discipline at this particular moment in our lives together on Earth, made even more so perhaps by the arrival of the coronavirus epidemic, slipping out of our children's grasp? Is it becoming one of the dying arts? I'll turn briefly for reference to the latest results of the well-known, sometimes controversial, national NAPLAN tests, which have indeed been cancelled this year because of the coronavirus, and it may well be that this will mark the natural death of NAPLAN in its current form, at any rate. Now, although there is a great deal of heated discussion on the merits of the various rival theories of how to teach children to read, it would nonetheless appear on the latest results of NAPLAN that Australian children learn to read reasonably well. In 2019, when 95% of 9-year-old Australian children were tested for reading, close to 30% of them scored in the highest band, and I think that 30% could safely be described as good readers. But by the time Australian children reach year 9, so just a few years later when they're about 15 years old, this score takes a dramatic dive. From 30% in year 3, only 4.5% of year 9 students score in the highest band of reading. Although one would usually assume the more years of education you have, the better educated you will be, this same sharp descent is mirrored in all the aspects of language that NAPLAN tests related to reading, that is spelling, grammar, punctuation, and writing. In fact, only 3% of 15-year-olds score in the top band for writing. So 3% in the top band for writing, 4.5% in the top band for reading in year 9. Has being a good reader and a good writer, surely the cornerstone of all education, already become an elite activity by age 15 and only for the lucky few? In a country as peaceful and affluent as Australia, that seems an incredible state of affairs. And whatever view you take of NAPLAN testing, whether you feel it's simply recording something happening on a certain day under certain circumstances and perhaps of negligible value, or whether you feel, as is argued, that it's part of an armoury of pedagogic tools designed to improve performance, one can only make the observation that if it's meant to improve performance, it's not working. So why does the ability to read well at the age of 9 fall to pieces over the course of a few years? Well, obvious as it sounds, there's only one way to become a better reader, and that is by reading. There's no other way. So they're reading less. The digital age, as we've noted, is not itself a barrier to learn to read. 30% of good readers at age 9 tested in 2019 were born in 2010, so they're all what we call digital natives. And many of them would have been playing with their phones since they mastered the basic hand grasp at a few months old. In fact, the digital age may help with learning to read if the number of educational learn to read apps that are around or anything to go by. And children, I think, are still excited about learning to read, as they should be. It's an extraordinary power, and changes their lives forever. But as they grow older, something is falling away. You might say, looking at them, that the young are always reading, perhaps more than ever before, with their heads, like all of us, bent constantly over screens and devices. But what are they reading? Well, they're not reading books. Like most of us, dare I say, they are sending each other messages, playing games, skimming through things that pop up that are of interest. To learn to read is one thing, and to learn to read at increasing levels of sophistication and concentration is another. Reading more, reading widely, reading deeply. Reading, you could say, out of the comfort zone of contemporary language, however rich and fascinating that language is. A high school teacher in Melbourne told me a few years ago now at a conference that she believed that very soon her students, including her good students, would lose the ability to read books, even from the comparatively recent past. She cited the short stories of Henry Lawson, which her students found too hard to read. They couldn't understand it. And the point is not whether they should or shouldn't be reading Henry Lawson. The point is, I think, that Henry Lawson's prose is not difficult or dense. It's clear as a bell, but it's not contemporary. It's not the more or less instantaneously comprehensible language of people their own age and their own time. To read even a single book, especially a book written by someone from another time and place to your own, requires an order of concentrated, uninterrupted attention. To read a book that's slightly harder to read or different to the last book you read, while definitely bringing joy, it's also a discipline. And like all achievements of the mind or body, it requires effort and practice and time and space. And in this instance, I would have to argue books. So looking first at books, you can, of course, as we know, read books on screen. And at the moment, with the indefinite closing of libraries and bookshops, most of us will have to read more books on screen than we're used to. And there's no lack of opportunity or availability of the world's literature on screen. It's at your literal fingertips. And again, there are dozens of apps to help you read books on screen. Look at all the e-books that the children will borrow from the library and read now they're at home during the shutdown, so we are told. The problem is, by and large, certainly up until now, we haven't wanted to read books on screen. Sales of digital books for both children and adults have remained low compared to the sales of paper and cardboard books. And if you look at the public library system, of the millions of items that are borrowed each year from Australian public libraries by children and adults, only a very small percentage of them are digital books, while the vast majority are paper and cardboard books. This, of course, was not according to plan. Paper books were supposed to disappear with the march of digital technology. But they have persisted, at least up until a week ago, as a kind of recalcitrant object, as the social scientists might say. We want them, even though we're not supposed to. Children in particular want books. When I visit schools across Australia, children who grew up with screens in their cribs herd forward implacably towards the book I have in my hand. They want to touch it, clutch it, hold it to their chest, almost breathe it in, run off with it, find a place to sit or lie down with it, to open it, stare at it, think, sink into silence and read, in the zone, concentrating, lost in a book. Who knows what habits of the long centuries will change after months of coronavirus. But up until now, when we read what we have liked to read, most of us, in preference, for want of a better word, is the physical book. And this brings us to libraries. To create a generation of readers, children need access to a lot of books. It's a great and good thing, of course, and should only be encouraged to buy a children a book as a prize or a gift and have books on the shelf at home. But to become a good, fluent, adventurous reader, a child needs more books than any one home can provide. They need thousands of books to choose from. And thousands of books means libraries. They need the freedom of a library to experiment, to find books they like, books they don't like, books they'll read 100 times, books they'll cast aside on the first page. Fiction or non-fiction, it's a process. Slowly but irresistibly, they'll form their own taste and develop their own ability to choose. And then they will love reading because they've chosen it and keep reading throughout their life. Read for your life, that's my slogan for the Australian Children's Laureate for the next 2 years. Now, you would think standing up for libraries would be a bit like reading, an uncontroversial topic. But libraries are a great irritant to some people, I've noticed, especially to some educators. Now, libraries in schools come in many forms. I've visited schools with wonderful, vibrant libraries and brilliant, effective librarians. I've also visited schools who have a room called a library, but no librarian, no regular times for the children to visit and borrow, and the room is opened once a year when the author comes to visit, to find it full of hoops and basketballs. I have also visited schools where libraries have been deliberately dismantled as a progressive act, librarians redeployed, and the rooms once filled with books recreated as learning hubs. Indeed, departments of education across the country are building brand new schools where they make a virtue of not having a library. No need for a library. Apparently, there's a flexible iHub on every floor with a pre-selected shelf of books in rotation. I remember asking my father once, who went to Neutral Bay Public School in the 1930s, "Did you have a school library, Dad?" And he replied rather vehemently, "Yes, a box of old books under the teacher's desk." And now it seems they were quite avant-garde at Neutral Bay with a 1939 prototype of the flexible iHub. And just to pause a moment to consider the symbolic value of a library in our schools and communities. What did that primary school library that I stepped into, full of sports equipment, followed by 45 puzzled children scrambling to find a place to sit for their author talk, say about the importance of reading in education and life to those children? And what does a brand new 17-storey departmental school in Parramatta, built without a library, say about reading to those adolescents? I've heard the argument, "Oh, you can have the books on the shelves, but the kids won't read them." Well, they certainly won't read them, 100%, if they're not there. Even the word itself, library, seems to upset some people. At one of my son's schools over the summer holidays, the library was renamed, rather in the spirit of Mr. Gradgrind himself, the Information Centre. Although the students, with their own instinctive recalcitrance, continued to call it the library. Information Centre isn't even an accurate renaming. Of course we go to libraries for information and for research and for school projects, and that's a noble and vital part of a library's purpose. But if we go back to those public library statistics, of those millions of items borrowed every year, the vast majority are fiction, children's and adults. And so a library for most people, and children are people, is an imagination centre first. And it's a place where you become a reader. A child becomes a reader for life, not by chance, but by opportunity. And so to public libraries. A while ago, I was in the audience at a Sydney Writers Festival event, and the conversation of the panel turned to how to encourage children's reading. And one of the panel members spoke in a very heartfelt way about a program she was involved with, and one of several that exist, through a combined effort of charities and publishers that provide children with a free book to take home. And this person argued how terrible it was that some children did not own any books, and this program would redress this and thereby help children love reading. Now, I'm not challenging that book possession is a great thing. I'm a writer, so obviously I want people to buy books, and I couldn't feel more strongly in support of bookshops and book suppliers. But I do remember thinking at the time, I didn't put up my hand, but this is what I thought, well, why not just get them to join the local public library? Wouldn't that be the simplest thing? Especially for families without money for books. The library, that amazing replenishing free resource established here in New South Wales by the great 1939 Library Act, and then all over Australia, open to everyone, where every child in Australia can borrow books at no cost, as many as they like, ad infinitum. I wondered, did people perhaps not know about public libraries? As a child who was brought up going regularly to the library wherever we lived, the bounty of the library was an unquestioned part of my everyday life. Every Saturday morning, off I went on the bus to borrow my 6 books, brought them home, and then spent the rest of the weekend reading. I was obviously a big reader. Then back again the following Saturday to do it all over again, week after week, driven purely by the desire to read. Talking about this library habit with a friend of my own age recently, though, I was quite taken aback. My friend, who'd grown up in an affluent middle-class suburb of Sydney, with, by the way, a very nice public library, told me that as a child she had never been there. And when she walked past it, she would actually peer through the open door of the local, wondering if she was allowed inside. In just the same way, she told me, that she peered through the open door of the local TAB. Now, of course, this is only one person, but it struck me with force that possibly not everybody does know about the wonders of the public library. About 40% of Australians are currently members of their local public library, if we take Australia as a whole. Meaning they've gone into the library, they've showed their ID, and they've been issued with their own library card. And that doesn't include all the people that spend time at the library without becoming a member. But even on its own, I think 40% is quite a remarkable statistic. That's a lot of people voluntarily to join a public institution. But why isn't everybody a member, as is their right? Why isn't every child a member of the local library? And so that's how I decided that my quest for the 2 years of my laureateship would be, as a single practical thing that I could do, would be to urge every child in Australia to get down to their local library and join up. Get their own library card with their own name on it and let themselves loose among the books. Now, public libraries, in contrast to school libraries, are flying high, or have been up to the very last moment, when they've all been temporarily closed, of course, for the duration of the virus. But councils all over Australia have been building new and wondrous local libraries. I visit them both as an author and as a member of the New South Wales Library Council. The flagship building of the municipality these days is far more likely to be the library than the town hall. And my own local library, Marrickville Library, is a typical example. What a dreary old dungeon it was for the past 20 years. But late last year, a new library was opened. Beautiful, large and light, shelves and shelves of books, study rooms, reading nooks, gardens and verandas. It's full of people, day and night, and full of children, or was until recently, piling up their books and staggering out the door with them. Nobody could possibly walk into Marrickville Library and think that the age of the book was over. Last year, just up the road here, the New South Wales State Library opened their very first library for children in that great institution. Again, it's filled with books and filled with children. There are no screens. What for? Children don't look books up in catalogues. They run up and down the shelves, they pull out the spines, exploring the world of literature with energetic freedom. They choose whatever they like and reject what they don't like. In the children's library, they will always be welcome, and they will never run out of books. And if they never run out of books, they will never stop reading. Of course, at the moment, children cannot go down to the library. Many of them will be able to join their local library online, and then they'll be able to use their library cards to borrow e-books and audiobooks and film and television series and music. They can also watch story times on shared videos and hundreds of other things that libraries provide. Libraries and librarians, I know, are doing everything possible to keep children involved with reading. But like librarians and library staff everywhere, I feel tremendously sad that the children cannot go to the library. And I do wonder, time will show the impact of this rupture of the virus on the reading lives of children. My sister-in-law said to me memorably once, "Ursula, the Jewish mother never gives up." I am not a Jewish mother, but I happen to agree with her. We cannot give up. The library doors will open again, and we must return to books and to libraries, and to reading, that gateway to the vast and wonderful world of literature, past, present, and future, which seems sometimes, on the face of it, slowly to be swinging shut on the next generation. Great works of literature are not so easy to come by. They are rare. We can't afford to cast aside books for our children simply because they have become too hard to read. Thank you.
Okay, Ursula, love that. Terrific. As someone who taught older children for some years, yes. I understand a lot of what you were saying. And it is difficult, and times have changed, and the way children absorb information or absorb ideas or imagination has changed. So you're really a wonderful children's writer. Tell us what makes a good children's book. I mean, it is hard to get them into it. So what are the tricks of the trade? I mean, that it's an easy read, that it's entertainment, that great themes, a page turner. I mean, the titles of your books are intriguing: Red Shoe, Blue Cat, Too Many Elephants in the Room, in this house. So tell us what's a good book.
Those titles that you read, they're also for a range of age groups. So, of course, a good book will depend on what age a child is. But in some ways, and this is not at all wanting to avoid the question, but I suppose it's in a lot of ways why I'm so keen on this idea of joining the public library, because I think it is very difficult to find the right book for a child, as all parents know and all teachers know and all librarians know. And I think, you know, many of whom work very hard to find that right book and have a series of disappointments and the occasional jackpot. So I suppose my feeling is, you know, as a child, and children are still like this when you go down to the library and see them wandering around the shelves, that children are in some senses quite open-minded, yeah, and will just wander up and down the shelves and will pull something out either randomly or attracted by something that we don't even know. Mm-hmm. And will start to read it and then might well toss it aside.
Yep.
Or may really love it. And I suppose, in answer to your question, in a sense, if I had a very, very reluctant reader on my hands, which I know some people do,
many,
I guess what I would tend to do, well, what I would do, and I would hope that, and I believe eventually it would work, is I would take that child, and it might be a teenager, down to the local library and get them to join up and give them the card. And then I would say to them, just go and pick one book. That's what I ask you, one book. You don't even have to read it, just go and pick it. And I can totally imagine there'll be quite a few children or adolescents who'll say, there is not one single book in this entire library I have the slightest interest in. Mm-hmm. And then I would simply accept that.
Yes.
And then I would go back the following week. And the following week, and the following week. And I find it impossible to believe, I just simply cannot believe it, that in that whole range of books in the library, that eventually that reluctant reader will find, sorry, it's sort of a terrible term, reluctant reader, it sounds a bit sort of menacing, that unwilling reader or will find something that they are interested in. And I suppose I feel human motivation, you know, is, you know, it's a deep mystery, but it's very important. And if you do want the children to read, I think that they're like us, you know, if you want people to do something, they need to want to do it. Yeah. And so I think what you want to do, I suppose, is to maximise the possibilities of them finding an opportunity to want to do it. I suppose that's why I get upset by this, the libraryless school, because it just seems to be cutting out those opportunities.
Yes.
You know, and parents can give the children those opportunities by taking them to the local library. If they're lucky enough at a school, and some schools are fantastic with fantastic librarians and fantastic teachers who do a lot to encourage children to read. But in the end, I think they find them, as you would have yourself as a child, you find what you love to read. You know, it's not that you don't take recommendations, and are not, I'm not, you know, suggesting there's no room for thoughtful and particular recommendation for a particular child. But I think in the end, it is a kind of, it's this sort of a, it is a kind of an act of you know, it is an act of one individual mind, isn't it, in the end, to find what they want to read. And in a way, I suppose it's what I do also kind of love about school, local libraries, is that in a sense, because it's not part of the school, which for some kids, that's not a helpful connotation for them. And they might look on a librarian as another teacher who's trying to make them do something. And obviously their parents try to make them do things. But I guess in a sense, down at the local library, there's this kind of privacy as well. The librarians, you know, you just borrow what you want to borrow. Nobody's peering over your shoulder. Nobody's asking you to write a book report. Nobody's, you know, there's that sort of sense of personal freedom and engagement on your own terms with what there is to offer.
Yes. What about the craze to read the same thing? How do you feel about that? Now, I remember being about 8 years of old age and my teacher saying to my mother, she's got to stop reading Ian Blight and it's just too, you know, too much sort of like soppy stuff. Get on to something that's a little bit more advanced. And I was pushed by my mother to do that. That was fine. But there are a lot of kids who get a craze to read the same sort of thing. Now, I'm not putting in Game of Thrones, but I have a 15-year-old grandson who got totally into Game of Thrones books, and then he's moved on to the forgotten his name now, the one who wrote forget about it, but a very highly qualified, good young adult reading. But he started out by sort of getting involved in the craze of something. What about that sort of thing?
Well, I absolutely applaud it. I agree. Look, my mother was a librarian, and I also was crazy about Anna Blyton. And I remember it upset my school librarian a bit. But I know my mother took the view, and I think she's right, that reading is also, it's a habit as well. Mm-hmm. It's a habit you have to develop and an association with pleasure.
Yeah.
And in some senses, I think, while that's the other thing about, I suppose what I was saying about the public library is that you're not being judged for what you're reading.
Yes.
And I suppose if you want reading to be associated with very kind of positive vibes in kids, it probably is important not to judge too much what they're reading, but just to let them read it. Mm-hmm. And you know, develop that discipline and habit and the association of pleasure with reading. And in a sense, you do. I also, you know, moved out of Enid Blyton, and now I'm unable to read Enid Blyton. I cannot concentrate on a single paragraph. But at the time, the richness it fed my imaginative life was enormous. You know, you would have been the same reenacting these games.
The
page turner. And you just wanted to read it.
It was like having McDonald's every day for dinner.
Yeah, and so, you know, you do want people to read to eat more than McDonald's, and eventually they do.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, isn't it? You know, you've probably noticed with your own children, you know, that complete obsession with eating white bread, and then mysteriously at a certain age, they all seem to want to eat bread full of seeds and, you know.
Well, that's maturity,
grains.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah,
maturity.
That's right.
And knowledge of what the world's really all about. Now, a lot of your books take children into unfamiliar places, you know, into which is what good children's book does, you know. into the imagination. But to what extent does that rely too on having familiar themes and recognition of certain things? Give us some examples of that.
That is, I suppose, the difficulty, isn't it? That you know, we read for comfort and then we read for discomfort. Mm. And I suppose reading is both things. Mm. And for my novels, for example, that you mentioned, The Red Shoe and the Blue Cat and The Golden Day, they're all, they're probably for children, I don't know, 12 or 13, but or possibly slightly younger, possibly slightly older. But one is set in the 1950s, one in the 1940s, and one in the 1960s. And the themes are some of... My view with children's books is there's really nothing that one says must be excluded. I don't really feel that, but I feel it depends how it's told.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's some of the things in some of those books are quite tough.
Mm-hmm.
But in all three of those novels, what I was aiming for there was I wanted books that were easy to read,
mm-hmm.
but quite hard to understand, if you know what I mean. So I wanted so the language is not... it's not dense,
mm, mm, mm.
but I wanted the sensation of when you finish the book, which is, I suppose, the kind of books I like, that you as you say, you're at ease in the language and you feel like you're understanding everything, and then you get to the end and you sort of like, what was that all about? Mm. That sort of sense of mystery, I suppose, unfinished mystery. Look, I'm when it comes to good children's books, I'm pretty fanatical about myself. I can't tolerate mediocre language, so I look for language myself first. I'm aware that's not the case of many adult and children readers, so it's not a priority for some readers, but for me it's an absolute priority. And I suppose when I'm writing, that's the thing I'm thinking about most. Look, you know, when you sort of are running writing workshops and things like that, this is more for adults than children who don't ask things like how do I create a character, but adults do. And I think in a sense that's, again, my books probably are strong in character. They're much stronger in character and language than they are in plot. The plot for me is the great struggle, the you know, the terrible stress. You can get there, but it's a great struggle. Whereas I was told this right at the beginning when I published my very first novel called Zizzy Zing about 30 years ago, that I had the opposite problem to most children's writers, because most children's writers are very good on plot,
yes,
and the
yes.
character and language is not particularly interesting, whereas I had the opposite problem. That mm-hmm. So I tend to think, so why, the reason I'm mentioning that is, you know, in the writing workshops it seems to me there's not much you can do to teach someone to create a character, that that probably just is, it's probably like acting, it's something that some people for whatever reason have a certain tendency to be able to do. It's not something you can sort of, I remember actually when I was a child, those sort of writing exercises you did at school where you had to, you know, create a character of not a bush ranger, a swagman or something
yes.
that. And you had to write all these paragraphs of description. And I've never been a descriptive writer. And my writing has very... In fact, I don't even know what my characters look like on the whole. So I think the thing about writing, and I say this to children always when I talk about writing to children, is it's an exploration. You know, you've got to discover what kind of writer you are. You can train yourself to write a good description, but if you're not a naturally descriptive writer, it's probably not going to be very interesting. Whereas, you know, other writers can do everything. And then some writers are fantastic descriptive writers. So, sorry, that's probably... I suppose what I'm trying to say is, you know, the world of literature is just so varied and vast.
Yes, yes.
And so it would seem a pity, I guess, with children. That's why, I guess, as I said, you know, that access to thousands of books that you get in a library. I mean, when I go to a local library, sometimes when you go into the library, you can see that it's almost, some libraries seem to operate almost like they're a bookshop. You know, they'll have 20 copies of the latest Len Dayton or something. And because that's what their customers want, and that'll get the statistics up. And they're under their own pressures
mm-hmm.
with their council and so on, and I'm not really arguing with that.
But when I go into a library, I also expect to find, and I would hope to find this in school libraries, a kind of repository of the national culture as well, and international culture, that it's not just a place where you find the latest contemporary book that everybody's reading, but there are books on the shelves which perhaps, I mean, that was one of my great pleasures at my own school library, would be wandering around that 800 section of world literature and just looking at the titles, you know, even if I didn't pull them out. But it's a kind of engendering of knowledge, whereas if you're not even ever going to have that opportunity, you won't even, I mean, you have no way in then. Yeah.
It's interesting when I think about children's literature, and we use this term suspend your disbelief.
Yes.
How much is it easier to do that with children's literature than with adults? I know we have the fantasy adult literature and all of that, Game of Thrones, whatever. But with children, when you talk about plot, with children, I'm telling the worst stories to my grandchildren at late at night, getting them to go to sleep. There's always a witch, and we always solve the problem with an absolutely impossible event happens, so it all comes to a happy ending. But to what extent can you use that sort of suspended disbelief? I'm thinking of the Chimneys of Greenough, and where ghosts and things blend with the story to bring about a resolution which is quite adult and a learning experience. So how much can you use suspended disbelief in children's writing to get to the end?
That's such a good point, and it seems to me often when you're reading about, you know, traditions of magic realism or so, and you feel people, some adult readers don't remember or never read children's books because it's such a standard way of storytelling from picture books up, this kind of, I suppose that's what I was saying about that openness of children to this strange and bizarre and extraordinary. I mean, when you were describing your witch story, it sounds like, you know, ancient Greek tragedy, you know, when people expected shock and astonishment, in a sense. So I think one of the great, that's certainly when I'm writing picture books, it's interesting, look, my books for older children, look, they do have a slightly, you might call it a paranormal element in a couple of them, but on the whole, they're realist novels.
Yeah.
Whereas when I'm writing for younger children, it's just so the, you know, you imagine a little boy who lives in a house with 100 elephants, and you don't, with any children, you never have to kind of, nobody ever asks, no child ever asks, I've read that story to thousands of children, but it's not possible to have elephants in the house.
Why do you think that is?
I suppose it's a bit like, I remember when my daughter Maisie was 5 or 6, we found a film of, a Super 8 film of man landing on the moon. And we, of course, remembered that as this great impressive moment of our childhood. And we were playing it to Maisie on the wall of our house. And I just remember she was not particularly impressed. And it reminded me, perhaps she was more like 3 or 4, but it just reminded me, why would you be at the age of 3 or 4? You sort of, the world is anything. You know, the world is millions of possibilities. And I suppose, look, it's true that if you do poetry workshops with children who are just learning to read and write, you get the most extraordinary images that they come up with, which, you know, by the time they're in year 3, they will have edited them out as sort of not conventional enough.
Yeah.
You know, so I suppose there is a, you know, there's loss and gain in growing up, and I guess that kind of extreme openness to wonder and accepting of. They also, I wrote a novel called Abyssinia some years ago, which is quite, as a narrative, it's quite peculiar, and it's about a doll's house, and certainly teenagers and adults who read it have a, not exactly a belligerent attitude to it, although some of them, but there's a kind of, almost like a kind of anger. Well, what was that all about? Like, why did that happen kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Whereas I've noticed in the primary schools, those questions never arise. They accept the logic of the dream, let's put it that way.
That's
and
a good point.
The way we do when we dream, we're not saying, well, that couldn't happen. We just, so there's some
funny, I don't know, I guess it's some sort of mental capacity that, that you know, with maturity disappears.
The secret is to keep that imagination, not lose it entirely, isn't it?
Yes, and I suppose children's writers must have some, you know, why, because, for example, I never particularly sat down and decided I wanted to be a children's writer. I wanted to be a writer from when I was about six. I wanted to be a writer. But it was only as I, and I suppose if you'd asked me as a teenager, I would never have thought I wanted to be a children's writer. It wasn't any kind of burning ambition. But in my 20s, when I was sitting down and trying to actually be a writer, I found it was only when, it was actually on the suggestion of a friend that I write something for children. I'd been sort of not been able to finish things or nothing worked, or it was a very frustrating, very common experience when you want to be a writer.
Writer's block.
That's right. It was just ghastly. And then somebody suggested writing a children's book and a picture book. And I just remember this, that sort of strange feeling of ease. I, you know, and it kind of flowed out of the pen. May I say, most of my books do not flow out of the pen. So that was an unusual experience. It must have been a lot of pent up something. But it certainly was, I realised that, that's what I'm supposed to be writing. And every time I sit down to write, I don't sort of say to myself, well, now I'm going to write a children's book. I just think I'm going to sit down and write. But it's a children's book that appears on the page. So, you know, who knows what that's all about.
How much is the problem with reading today about concentration?
A lot of our young
people have a real difficulty with taking themselves into anything for a length of time.
I think it's enormous. I think it's enormous. And that's why I'm also kind of sceptical about how they're all going to be reading all these books on their phones and their devices, because the nature of phones and devices is they're completely disruptive, and that's why we like them, you know, like they're just, we're just always on edge, they're momentary. And to read, you know, I do, like I'm sure you do, and most adult readers do, read books on my phone. I definitely do, and it's got great advantages. You know, I'm never without a book in my pocket. But in terms of, I mean, I've absolutely noticed it in myself. The concentration levels have changed from what it was before we had this device-ridden age. So I suppose my answer to that is, you know, is it's just that whatever a device is, and they may well produce very engaging book-like artifacts that will be on devices, but they actually won't be books. It'll be a different experience. Yeah. And so I suppose I think people just have to bear that in mind, that a book as a it is a different experience.
It's interesting that Sydney Grammar a year or two ago banned computers in their school.
Yes.
And I wonder if this has something to do with the problem of lack of concentration, maybe, or does it help to take us off it, a bit like going cold turkey?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I remember one of my sons was in whatever year nine, when whatever that was called, you know, when they rolled out all the free laptops. And, you know, very laudable to make technology accessible to every child in the country. And yet, you know, I have to say, within a month at school, you know, by their own admission, they were just playing games all the time, and that the school would then bring in some firewall, which was very naive because the children knew exactly how to get over it. It was hilarious. So, and then indeed, I think probably certainly within 18 months, they were not using them in an educational sense at all. So, but you know, my son who I was talking about before, who's a maths teacher, all of his maths teaching is through screens. So I'm not a kind, it's fantastic.
Well, that's perfect.
It's that. Brilliant. But it's not reading a book. So it's not that one is against screens in schools. Obviously,
they're
vital and brilliant and fantastic. Yes. But a book is a different thing. And I think that just has to be borne in mind. And it's as I was saying, I'm afraid it is a discipline. That's why it's great to read Enid Blyton and browse on end, because
because
develop
you get into the habit.
That
of
habit.
Sitting.
You know, and you won't develop the habit if you do it for 5 minutes or even 3 minutes, and then you're checking your email or something pops up, or you know, it's very and then I just think that's an enormous loss. I suppose all I think about that is that you know, okay, we could wipe our hands and say, well, that's over, and now this is now. And it just seems to me the number of great things
in the history of the world. Mm. You know, they're not. We can't afford to be so prodigal and just sort of say, oh, well, we don't need that anymore. I mean, you know, the thousands of years of human civilization are not, you know, to be just sort of shrugged
off.
Yes,
I often say about archives that they'll bring out a box when some student in a few decades' time asks for something and they'll bring it out and they'll say, now, this is a book.
Yes.
And
yes.
It doesn't have a search engine.
That's right.
But then this goes back to background. And you're referring to that program about books in homes.
Mm.
Books in homes, because I've been involved in it through Rotary, is actually for people in long distance, you know, in the outback. It shouldn't be used around Sydney unless it's a really impoverished area where people are literally not used to books. So how important is the home? Because what that program does is it gives books to kids on a basis of so many per term that they can take home, where the home may not have a book in it.
No, look, and I hope I'm not sounding like I'm totally not against those programs.
No.
It's just that in certain circumstances I'm sceptical.
Yeah, because they may not have a library. See, at Stuart Town, where I was involved, they don't have a library.
Yes.
The school's got.
Although you have mobile
pupils.
Libraries.
All over the state,
yeah,
they will drive in these little buses. Mm-hmm. They're amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and the Outback, what's it called? The. Not the Outback Caravan Library, but in Western New South Wales, they've got this fantastic, you know, so the councils buy these buses and they all fit up like a library.
I just think, I've read the studies, which I'm impressed by, that children who have come from homes with a lot of books in them do better at school, but simply putting the books in that home is a big ask for those books, I suppose, is what I mean. That you may be taking a book home to a family with literally no interest in books and no understanding of even what to do with those books. You know, that it's just another thing that they have. So I don't want to sound... I know there's a number of these excellent programs, and there's, I think, is it the Dolly Parton Imagination Library also does something like that. So it is can only be applauded, but I suppose that's the other thing. I do feel that and as you say, if there are children who literally can't get to the library, but if they can get to the library, if the library can come to them, then I think it's got that advantage of that enormous choice of books and the sense of plenty, the sense of more coming. You know, look, it's been pointed out to me by a good friend of mine, she's quite right, that in a certain generation, people became excellent readers and all they read was the Bible, you know.
That's
and
right.
That
and
is
quoted from it.
Indisputable, right? And they also became excellent writers. So, you know, that's another point in question.
That's right.
But I think in terms of what I mean, the magpie... For our 2 years as laureate, I guess what I had to think to myself is, what is just sort of one practical thing that I can do? And so I guess that's why I'm so concentrating on this one practical thing, join the library.
Well, I think the library idea is marvellous.
Mm.
I live in North Sydney and I know grandchildren of mine that have gone to school in that area. The library is where they all go to do their homework.
Yes.
Lots of them. The library is a public space.
That's right.
The real problem for a lot of young people, especially in suburbs that are not as advantaged as that suburb, is there's not a lot of public space.
Yes.
And I
yes.
think libraries is an ideal public space. The problem is to get the libraries to be what you think they should be. So what are your ideas? Are you going to be actively going about the library? I know that it's a terrible time to be saying that.
Look, it's so sad.
But you can
kind
of communicate with libraries. I mean, they could have book fairs. They could do all sorts of things.
They do. And look, in fact, there's an awful lot going on, and it depends, you know, particularly which library you go to and what's happening. And I think more and more, as the libraries are supported by their councils, I do think there's been a kind of renaissance of local libraries in that sense. Because as I was saying, my local library was so terrible.
It looks fantastic now.
It's divine. Mm. And it is just this beautiful thing. And you can only think that is a wonderful thing for that municipality.
Mm.
Whereas before it was, you know, what's reading? You'd have to be desperate. I think... with public libraries, school libraries, I think it's for me, I want to hopefully celebrate them all and not feel that school libraries are thinking I'm concentrating too much on public libraries or vice versa. There's all sorts of people out there that are passionate about their particular sector of libraries, and my view is that every library, including private libraries, is to be celebrated.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, I've personally always just felt completely, you know, my attention levels drop every time I go into a library, and it's just, and you want that feeling for everybody, that everybody feels that it belongs to them, in a sense. I had a funny experience many years ago when I worked for the public service in Canberra, and 35 years ago, and in my break, I always used to go in, I was at the Department of Administrative Services in what was then called West Block, and I used to go into the library, and they had a few shelves, and there was a librarian there, and I, you know, and then I'd go back to my clerical desk and do my work. But I was probably in the library every day, and eventually the librarian said to me, because my surname was Coleman, and she said to me, "Is your father's name Peter?" And I said, "Yes. Why do you ask?" And she said, "Well, I used to work in the Parliamentary Library, and he was in the library every single day, and you just look similar." And it made me laugh too, because I wasn't particularly aware that Dad was so fanatically into libraries, but we must have just, as a family, felt that. That sense of ownership of libraries in a funny way. Like, I obviously felt I could go to the library, and many of the other public servants clearly didn't even feel it had any... I don't know, maybe they didn't even think they could go in there. I know I lived for a year on a kibbutz. I was in the kibbutz library on a daily basis, and thank heavens they had quite a good English language section. I read so many books on that kibbutz. So I just want that... I suppose what I want children to feel is that the library is there for them, that it's not this, like my friend who never went in, you know. I just couldn't understand how that could be, that, you know, there is a library, walk in the door, it belongs to you, and that's the feeling.
So, library's closed.
Yeah.
And parents being the educators with help of their schools, what are some of the tips, let's round up on that, that you would, what advice would you offer to those parents who... tuned in, trying to do their best. How can reading be part of that homeschooling? What are the tips?
It's so difficult, isn't it? I suppose, well, look, what I've been saying when I've been asked that elsewhere is you can certainly... I suppose it's keeping books as this sort of daily part of life, and you can borrow books, you can lend books to each other. Perhaps you're not supposed to because of germs, I don't know, maybe spray them or something.
Disinfect them.
It's absolutely true that many public libraries you can join online and you can borrow e-books. It's not a huge library of e-books, it's limited, but it's still pretty big, and for children and for adults, but you can certainly do that. You can still buy books. You can definitely buy books, and they will get delivered to you one way or the other. And many bookshops are offering fantastic delivery services. So, you know, if you do want to make books part of that weekly budget, and that depends on having money, of course.
Grandparents could make little offerings.
That's right. Rather
buy a book for your grandchildren.
Yeah, because you can't
books.
Go to the movies,
no.
And you can't go
no.
ice skating. And I mean, it's funny, isn't it? A friend of mine was saying... when I was telling her she must go and join the local library, she said, "Oh, but all weekend she's doing sport or this, that, and the other." And I suppose I felt, I appreciate that, but she was very worried about her child not reading. If you actually want your child to read, then you actually have to make it a priority. It's sort of, in this particularly busy modern digital world, it's unlikely to happen by accident. You know, that's why you have to make those opportunities.
Yeah.
And so, reading aloud, reading to the dog, putting on plays. I put on lots of plays as a child from books, you know, to my poor parents, polite parents. Someone was saying that their child, which I thought was super cute, was set up their own little library themselves and put little cards in the books and lent them to their little friends and so on. I thought that was a sort of a very, you know, but in some senses, to me, this is why I guess there was a certain tone of melancholy in my speech, because I'm just wondering, because I wonder if these are sort of stopgaps, or what is the future really going to be?
And you've got a website, so
yeah.
What are your suggestions for April?
Oh, well.
Because I it's cute. I told my daughter to get onto it, because she's got primary school, at least three from primary school at home at the moment, and I thought some of the activities were great.
Very good.
What's April?
Well, April is April.
Pun, I think it was a pun, using
that's
puns.
Right. So we have, so the, every month, this is part of the Laureate program, I've sort of done a writing activity for children. It's sort of a one page, and you can print it out, and, or you, you know, whatever, and it's sort of, so for each month of the year, so we had February Flies, March Marches, and April Asks. So March, we wrote a marching song. In February, it was about puns. And in April, I'll have to rack my brains. I know it's
well,
April
everyone
asks.
Can go online and work it out.
Exactly. And so every month there will be a different writing activity coming up.
Well,
so
it's very pertinent right now.
It is. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, I'm also quite involved with the New South Wales School Magazine, which is part of the Department of Education. And they've done a special Laureate edition of the magazine, and they've, with sort of various stories and poems I've written over the years, and they've, you know, produced resources online to go with that. So I think there is a massive resources out there, in a sense, for parents that are sort of connected with reading.
Yeah.
But in the end, as I was saying in the speech, in the end, the only thing that makes you a good reader is reading. There's nothing else that will do it for you, you know. So the associated activities, I think, are fantastic. You know, the story times, the all those things I was just talking about. But in the end, you will only become a better reader if you read. And that has to be faced as a fact. There's, you know, it's just a plain fact. And I suppose that's my answer to, you know, someone who does want their child to be a better reader, that it won't happen if they don't read. That's
thanks.
All I want.
Thanks, Ursula. That was terrific. Thanks,
thank
Ursula.
You. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.